Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Thursday, June 8th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Rwanda reacts to the ruling of the UN War Crimes Court regarding genocide suspect Felicien Kabuga.
He would have preferred that the trial goes to a full decision with a conviction of Felicien Kabuga. But we will, of course, follow the case in its new format.
Burundi's opposition leader says the suspension of his party's activities is a sign that the country is being ruled by a dictatorship. The UNHCR appealed for additional humanitarian crisis funds due to an influx of refugees from Sudan. Uganda's Medical Association president cautioned the country to remain vigilant after President Museveni says he might have tested positive for COVID-19. Defense lawyers in Guinea-Conakry boycott the trial of the 2009 stadium massacre.
41 lawyers say they will not return to the court in Conakry if their payment demands are not met. The Minister of Justice last week said the trial will resume this week, but the lawyers stayed away.
And South African officials cracked down on the illegal trade of pangolins. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. This week, a UN War Crimes Court ruled that elderly Rwandan genocide suspect Felicien Kabuga is unfit to stand trial. Rwanda's ambassador in the Netherlands, where the court is based, has called the decision a disappointment and a disservice to the victims of the 1994 genocide in the country. However, Ambassador Olivier Nduhungirehe tells Edward Rema of VOA's Central Africa Service he is happy the court decided to proceed with an alternative procedure, which he calls a trial of facts.
The UN International Residual Mechanism for Criminal Tribunals decided that Felicien Kabuga is unfit to participate meaningfully in his trial and is very unlikely to regain fitness in the future. This is what the court decided. But the court didn't terminate the proceedings as requested by the defense. Rather, the court decided to conduct an alternative finding procedure, which is a procedure that is common in certain countries, especially the Commonwealth countries, which resembles to a trial, as parties will continue to examine the facts. So the prosecution will continue to present the facts, to call witnesses, but there will be no possibility of conviction. This is the difference. Because Kabuga was found not fit for trial. So that means that it's a trial of the facts, an examination of the facts. I believe that there may be appeal against this procedure, but this where we stand now, given the decision of an independent medical panel that led to a this decision of the court.
There being no conviction at the end of this trial, how is this going to be received among genocide survivors who were anticipating getting justice from this trial?
This situation was caused first and foremost by the fact that Felicien Kabuga was allowed to escape justice for more than 20 years. Now, we have this situation where we don't have a full trial. It's a disappointment, of course, for the victims of the genocide and for the government and for those who wanted justice for the victims. We would have preferred, in a normal circumstances, that the trial goes to a full decision with a conviction of Felicien Kabuga. It's a disappointment, but we will, of course, follow the case in its new format and then hope that the court will take the right decision.
What precedent do you think this is setting when Rwanda still has a lot of fugitives that is still trying to pursue, and most of them are also getting old, they're getting frail? Do you think at the end of the day, justice is going to be served?
As I said, this is the direct consequences of this of the situation of allowing genocide fugitives to escape justice for a long period. Since 1994, Rwanda sent abroad more than 1,000 arrest warrants, but among them, only few of them were acted upon by the countries. We have extraditions from a number of countries, but also trials in the countries, in the host countries. But the majority of those indictments are still there without any prosecution. So this should be a lesson for us and then for countries in the world where we send those indictments, that it's important to collaborate with Rwanda, but also with the tracking unit of the mechanism in order to give justice to the victims.
Ambassador Olivier Nduhungirehe is Rwanda's ambassador to the Netherlands. He was speaking with Edward Rema of VOA's Central Africa Service. In Burundi, the leader of the main opposition National Freedom Council Party, Agathon Rwasa, says the decision by the government to suspend the party's operations is yet another example that Burundi is ruled by a dictatorship. The government announced this week that it was suspending the group's operation because of alleged irregularities for ousting what the government called members who had opposed the party's leader. Rwasa tells me that the Burundian government is supporting people within the opposition whose aim, he said, is to do the bidding of the authorities.
We are very upset to see that the government is taking some harsh decision against our party, while our party has not infringed any law of this country. This is a sign that we are just living in a dictatorship, while the country officers or leaders are pretending that they are improving democracy inside Burundi.
So you have no idea what irregularities the government is referring to? Did you violate any rules?
We hadn't violated any rule of this country. And it is just a sign that the government is intended to make sure that there is no opposition in place.
The government says that all activities organized by irregularly constituted groups are suspended nationwide. Only meetings aimed at easing tensions within the party are authorized. Do you have issues within your party?
There is no issues, except that the government is just trying to support a group of less than 10 people who are just renegades, who are just changing their minds because they don't find themselves on in some positions where they would be expected to be serving the ruling party from within the CNL.
Constitutionally, can the government suspend your party?
No, it is just another way to show that this country doesn't comply with the law, because a political party can only be suspended if it has infringed the laws. And in the case, the minister refers to not a single law of Burundi that has been infringed, because there is none of it. So we just deplore the fact that this government is only pretending to do its business correctly while it fails on every ground. And in terms of what the minister is pretending, we held two national conventions of our party. The government, the Minister of Home Affairs, which deals with the political parties, was informed and could allow this national convention to be held. So how come now, more than a month and a half later, they pretend that this was not regular conventions? Just because there is a group which is manipulated by the regime, which is trying to implode the party, the minister then can pretend that it was not complying with the internal rules of CNL. And just imagine 9 people out of millions of members of the party. What kind of democracy this minister is trying to pretend to improve in this country?
In the meantime, Burundi has legislative elections coming up in 2025.
Yes, it means that this regime doesn't want to be in a race with other political parties when comes the elections 2025. That's why they are suppressing us, because we are the only opposition party which was remaining active.
Agathon Rwasa is the leader of Burundi's main opposition National Freedom Council party. He was speaking with us from the capital, Bujumbura. In Guinea, defense lawyers in the September 2009 Conakry Stadium massacre trial say they will continue to boycott the proceedings until their demands for payment are met. Former junta leader Musa Dadis Camara and 10 other top military officers are standing trial for the attack on opposition members that left more than 100 people dead. Reporter Karim Camara has more from Conakry.
41 lawyers say they will not return to the court in Conakry if their payment demands are not met. The Minister of Justice last week said the trial will resume this week, but the lawyers stayed away. The attorneys who are defending former junta leader Musa Dadis Camara and 10 top military officers say the ministry promised to pay for their services, but after 8 months, they have gotten nothing. They also have demanded improved working conditions. On September 28, 2009, security forces killed over 100 opposition supporters and raped dozens of women gathered at the stadium in Conakry. The suspects on trial are accused of masterminding the attack. Minister of Justice Alphonse Jasright says his department is not obligated to pay the lawyers and threatens to replace them if they do not return to the courtroom. He says he took into account one thing, which is improving working conditions in the court. He says that was quickly solved. Wright says his department did not agree to shoulder the financial needs of the lawyers and that he is ready to meet all obligations and commitment taken by his department, but not this demand. This means the Minister of Justice will likely replace 41 lawyers if the boycott continues. But one of the prosecutors, Sidiki Camara, dismissed the minister's threat. He said replacing all the lawyers with new state-hired lawyers 8 months after the opening of the trial will not work. He says it is true that under the penal code, a court could replace absent lawyers and hired lawyers of the state. But at this stage, it will be difficult to replace them. He says they heard that plans are underway for negotiations, which he hopes that will resolve the standoff. One of the striking lawyers, D.S. Ba, said it would be a disgrace to Guinea if the trial stopped halfway after the government had told the international community it has the capacity to hold the trial. He says it is time that people to look in the mirror and ask themselves if it's important to resolve issues with civility. Ba says Guinea is now seen as an unusual state after committing to organize the trial that it is capable. He says the state made cautious promises of financial support to the defense, which submitted a list of needs and agreed upon amount. The lawyer says their client cannot afford to pay them, so the court must do as agreed. The Justice Department complains of lack of funds for proceedings and says international partners who made financial pledges to the court have not yet delivered. The Ministry of Justice says trial will resume on June 19th, either with the same lawyers or new ones. Reporting for VOA Africa, I am Karim Camara in Conakry.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Thursday, June 8th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The president of the Uganda Medical Association says the announcement by President Yoweri Museveni that one of three COVID-19 tests he took on Wednesday morning turned out to be positive is an indication for Ugandans to continue to abide by their protocols against the virus. The Uganda Monitor reports that the president made his remarks Wednesday during his State of the Nation speech. The World Health Organization last week announced the end of COVID-19 as a public health emergency. Uganda Medical Association President Dr. Edith Naku Yoloba tells me that the positivity rate for the illness in Uganda is around 2%. Still, she says Ugandans should seek medical care whenever they experience COVID-like symptoms.
What I do make of this announcement by His Excellency, the President of Uganda, regarding testing positive for COVID-19 or having one test positive and one test negative, as was reported in the news, is that COVID-19 is still with us in Uganda. Maybe it's much lesser than it used to be, but as a medical practitioner, anecdotally, we've been hearing of clinical reports of people with signs similar to COVID-19, and I've had also reports from laboratories in and around Kampala that have started seeing an increased positivity rate for COVID-19. So this news that the president announced about his own health is not surprising given what we are seeing in Kampala, Uganda, as regards COVID-19 infection.
If the president's declaration is true, what should the people of Uganda know about COVID-19?
Thank you very much for that question. Regarding the test that the president reported, where one test was positive and one was negative in his test, I think his doctors will recommend further what he needs to do next. But regarding the laboratory tests that are coming up in Uganda, as I've reported to you that we've had that from various laboratories around you, at least some laboratories in Uganda have started seeing increased positivity of COVID-19 tests in the population. This means that Ugandans should be alert to the new infections that are being seen of COVID-19. And in that case, definitely, even though the WHO has announced an end to the big pandemic, it has not announced an end to any cases of COVID-19. And therefore, we would ask people to be again alert to any symptoms and signs that are suggestive of COVID-19 and seek medical care as soon as they feel symptoms that are similar to COVID-19. Second of all, we encourage people again to sanitize, wash their hands, wear masks when they're in crowds, and seek care as soon as they feel that they need it. And furthermore, they should make sure that they are vaccinated against COVID-19 because the vaccinations are available and have been found to be very effective. Furthermore, they should also make sure that those people who haven't got a booster dose do get a booster dose as guided by their doctors and by the guidelines that in the area. So that is what I advise Ugandans to do at this time and ask them to seek for medical care and help where they can get it from hospitals, from clinics, and places like that.
Dr. Edith Naku-Jaloba is president of the Uganda Medical Association. She was speaking with us from the capital, Kampala. A senior official of the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, is calling on the government of South Sudan and the international community to avert what he calls catastrophe. This as the ongoing conflict in Sudan continues to force South Sudanese returnees and Sudanese refugees into South Sudan. For VOA News, Wake Simon Wudu reports from Juba.
UNHCR's Assistant High Commissioner for Operations says $96 million is needed for addressing a dire humanitarian situation in South Sudan. Ralph Mazow, who is visiting South Sudan, told the reporters in Juba Wednesday that the South Sudan government and its international partners should address the looming humanitarian situation in the country.
If that doesn't happen, the arrival of a large number of people from Sudan could become a crisis which could negatively impact South Sudan.
Mazow traveled this week to Renk, the main transit center where a majority of South Sudanese returnees and Sudanese refugees escaping the conflict in Sudan are temporarily camping. He says the humanitarian situation in South Sudan could overwhelm aid workers.
So more is needed. More is needed to make sure that we avert a catastrophe. If you continue to have people crossing into South Sudan, we could reach a million in no time. So if you have a million people crossing into a country and not being provided with support and assistance that is required, first to be moved away from the border and then the support and assistance that they require in their place of origin, you imagine the impact that this is going to have on South Sudan.
He added that more than 1,500 people are crossing daily into South Sudan via various border points across the country. The UN Refugee Agency estimates that nearly 100,000 South Sudanese returnees have arrived in South Sudan following the outbreak of the conflict in Khartoum and other towns and cities from mid-April. The UNHCR official says South Sudan's government and aid agencies should scale up their efforts in addressing the unfolding humanitarian situation across the country.
The call is also made to the international community for funding, because we have made an appeal, and you're asking for how much we asked for. We asked for South Sudan specifically, we asked for $96 million, close to $100 million for a three-month period.
Mazao says UNHCR and partners have received 25% of the $96 million US aid appeal for addressing the humanitarian crisis in South Sudan. He says Sudan's crisis has caused what he describes as a regional crisis. For VOA News, I'm Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
Pangolins, a type of anteater, have been used in traditional Chinese medicine for centuries, but the demand for their skills is putting some pangolin species at high risk of extinction. Officials in South Africa are trying to ensure the animal's survival, cracking down on the illegal trade and rehabilitating rescue animals. Kate Butler reports from Lapalala Wilderness Reserve in Limpopo, South Africa.
That's also, I mean, the tail.
Kajima may only be a baby, but this pangolin has already experienced a harrowing life. Poachers caught him at just a few months old to be trafficked. Wildlife experts say the most likely destination was China. Fortunately for Kajima, South African authorities rescued him in a high-stakes sting operation. Kajima will soon be let free in the South African Wildlife Reserve. First, he is learning the basics of being an African anteater, how to burrow and find his own food. Volunteer Gareth Thomas is Kajima's foster parent.
Initially, I would obviously be a bit of a helicopter parent. I monitored him. I was with him 100% of the time. They have these incredible personalities. They have characters. They're incredibly charismatic. You know, and they're hyper aware, they're hyper intelligent.
Pangolins are revered in some parts of Africa, with myths and legends around the mammals, which are seen as the bringers of thunder, rain, and lightning. Elsewhere on the continent, they're eaten as bushmeat, but it's their use in traditional Chinese medicine that's pushed some pangolin species close to extinction. Despite no scientific evidence that their scales, which are made of the same substance as human fingernails, have any curative properties. Nikki Wright is co-chair of the African Pangolin Working Group.
With Chinese labor and workforces moving into Africa to perform various functions and actions, they've noticed obviously these huge piles of scales next to the bushmeat shops along roadsides and in forests, and started a trade with those because they have a need for them in their traditional Chinese medicine.
But animals such as pangolins are not just victims of opportunistic trade, says Glenn Phillips, who manages this highly protected reserve.
Now, this is organized crime. Snare poaching on a small scale is understandable because people are hungry. We know the economic situation. We understand that. The whole issue around rhino and pangolin is generally around organized crime and it's greed.
No one knows how many pangolins are left, but with tons of their scales leaving Africa's shores each year, wildlife experts say they are certain the mammals' numbers are declining rapidly. At least one African pangolin has avoided that unfortunate fate. Later this month, Kajima will be released to start his new life in the wild. Kate Bartlett for VOA News, Lapalala Wilderness Reserve, Limpopo, South Africa.
And that's it for this Thursday, June 8th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for being our guest this morning. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I am James Barty in Washington saying, have a great day, and please be safe whatever you do.